He took the Jaguar down the long palm-lined drive from the Mount Nelson Hotel. Considering the proposition and recalling his proposal of marriage and her outright rejection, he went out through the hotel gates and took the main road that skirted the old Malay quarter of District 6. He resisted the temptation to shoot the red of the traffic lights at the foot of Rowland Street. It was highly unlikely there would be other traffic at this time of the morning, but he braked dutifully and was startled when another vehicle shot out of the narrow cross street and turned in front of his bonnet. It was a sea-green Chevrolet station wagon, and he didn't have to check the number plate to know that it was Tara's. The headlights of the Jaguar shone into the cab of the Chev, and for an instant he had a full view of the driver. It was Tara's new chauffeur. He had seen him twice before, once at Veltefrieden and once in the House of Assembly. But this time the driver was bareheaded, and Shaza could see the full shape of his head. As he had on both the previous occasions, Shaza had a strong sense of recognition. He had definitely met or known this man before. But the memory was eroded by time and quickly extinguished by his annoyance. The chauffeur was not permitted to use the Chev for his own private purposes, and yet here he was in the small hours of the morning, driving around as though the vehicle belonged to him. The Chev pulled away swiftly. The chauffeur had obviously recognized Shaza, and the speed was proof of his guilt. Shaza's first instinct was to give chase and confront the man, but the traffic light was still red against him, and while he waited for it to change, he had time to reflect. He was in too good a mood to spoil it with unpleasantness, besides which any confrontation at 4 in the morning would be undignified and would inevitably lead to questions about his own presence at the same hour on the fringes of the city's notorious red light area. There would be a better time and place to deal with the driver, and Shaza let him go. But he had neither forgiven nor forgotten. Shaza parked the Jaguar in the garage at Veltefrieden, and the green Chev was in its place at the end of the line of cars, between Gary's MG and Shaza's customised Land Rover. As he passed it, he laid his hand on the bonnet of the Chev, and it was still hot, the metal ticking softly as it cooled. He nodded with satisfaction, and went on up to the house, amused by the necessity to creep up to his own suite like a burglar. He still felt light and happy at breakfast, and he hummed as he loaded his plate with eggs and bacon from the silver chafing dish on the sideboard. He was the first one down, but Gary was only a minute behind him. The boss should always be the first man on the job, and the last man off it, he had taught Gary, and the boy had taken it to heart. No, no longer boy, Shaza corrected himself as he studied Gary. His son was only an inch shorter than he was, but wider across the shoulders and heavier in the chest. Down the full length of the corridor, Shaza had often heard him grunting over his bodybuilding weights. Even though he had just shaved, Gary's jaw was blue with beard, that by evening would need the razor again, and despite the Brill Cream, his hair was already springing up in unruly spikes. He sat down beside Shaza, took a mouthful of his omelette, and immediately began talking shop. "He just isn't up to the job anymore, Pater. We need a younger man in that position, especially with all the extra responsibility of the Silver River mine coming on stream." "He's been with us 20 years, Gary," Shaza said. "Well, I'm not suggesting we shoot him, Dad. Just let him take his retirement. He is almost 70. "Retirement will kill him. If he stays, it will kill us." "All right," Shaza sighed. Gary was right, of course. The man had outlived his usefulness. "But I'll speak to him personally." "Thanks, Dad." Gary's spectacles gleamed victoriously. "Talking about the Silver River Mine, I've arranged for you to begin your stint up there just as soon as you've written your sup." Gary spent more time at Santon House than in his lecture rooms at business school. As a consequence, he was carrying one subject for his bachelor's degree in commerce. He would write the supplementary examination the following week, and Shaza was sending him up to work on the Silver River Mine for a year or two. "After all, it has taken over from the old Hani now, as the company flagship. I want you to move more and more into the centre of things." He saw the glow of anticipation behind Gary's spectacles. "Oh boy, I'm looking forward to really starting work, after bashing the books all these dreary years." Michael came bursting breathlessly into the dining room. Thank goodness, Pater, I thought I'd missed you. Oh, slow down, Mickey, Schauser cautioned him. You'll burst a blood vessel. Have some breakfast. Oh, I'm not hungry this morning. Michael sat down opposite his father. I want to talk to you. Well, open fire, then, Schauser invited. Not here, Michael demurred. I'd rather hoped that we could talk in the gunroom. And all three of them looked grave. The gunroom was only used on the most portentous occasions, and a request for a meeting in the gunroom was not to be taken lightly. Schauser glanced at his watch. Mickey, Harold Macmillan is addressing both houses. I know, Pater, but this won't take long. Please, sir? The fact that Michael was calling him sir underlined the seriousness of the request, but Schauser resented the deliberate timing. Whenever Michael wanted to raise a contentious issue, he did so when Schauser's opportunity to respond was severely curtailed. The lad was as devious as his mother, whose child he indubitably was, spiritually as well as physically. 10 minutes, then, Schauser agreed reluctantly. Will you excuse us, please, Gary? Schauser led the way down the passage and locked the gunroom door behind them. Very well. He took his usual place in front of the fireplace. Oh, what is it, my boy? I've got a job, Dad. Michael was breathless again. A job? Yes, I know you have a part-time job as a local stringer for the Mail. I enjoyed your report on the polo. In fact, you read it to me. Very good it was. Schauser grinned. All 5 lines of it. No, sir, I've got a full-time job. I spoke to the editor of the Mail, and they have offered me a job as a cub reporter. I start the 1st of next month. Schauser's grin faded into a scowl. Oh, damn it, Mickey, you can't be serious. What about your education? You have 2 more years to go at university. I'm serious, sir. I'll get my education on the newspaper. No, Schauser raised his voice. No, I forbid it. I won't have you leaving university before you are capped. I'm sorry, sir, I've made up my mind. Michael was pale and trembling, yet he had that obstinate set expression that infuriated Schauser even more than the words. But he controlled himself. You know the rules, Schauser said. I've made them clear to all of you. If you do things my way, there is no limit to the help I will give you. If you go your own way, then you are on your own. He took a breath and then said it, surprised at how painful it was. Like Sean. God, how he still missed his eldest son. Yes, sir, Michael nodded. I know the rules. Well, I have to do it, sir. There's nothing else I want to do with my life. I want to learn to write. I don't want to go against you, Pater, but I simply have to do it. This is your mother's doing, Schauser said coldly. She's put you up to this, he accused. And Michael looked sheepish. Well, Mater knows about it, he admitted. But it's my decision alone, sir. You understand that you'll be forfeiting my support. You'll not receive another penny from me once you leave this house. You'll have to live on the salary of a cub reporter. I understand, sir. Michael nodded. All right, then, Michael, off you go, he said. And Michael looked stunned. Is that all, sir? Unless you have some other announcement to make? No, sir, Michael's shoulders slumped. Except that I love you very much, Pater, and I appreciate all that you have done for me. You have a most peculiar way of demonstrating that appreciation, if you don't mind my saying so, said Schauser. He went to the door. He was halfway into the city, racing the Jaguar down the new highway between the university and Hooter Skewer, before he recovered from his affront at Michael's disloyalty. For that is how Schauser saw his son's decision. Now suddenly he began to think about newspapers again. Publicly, he had always disparaged the strange suicidal impulse that gripped so many successful men in their middle years to own their own newspaper. It was notoriously difficult to milk a reasonable profit from a newspaper, but in secret Schauser had felt the sneaking temptation to indulge in the same rich man's folly. Not much profit, he mused aloud, but the power to be able to influence the minds of people. In South Africa, the English press was hysterically anti-government, while the Afrikaans press was fawningly and abjectly the slave of the National Party. A thinking man could trust neither. What about an English-language paper that was aimed at the business community and politically uncommitted, he wondered, as he had before. What if I were to buy one of the smaller, weaker papers and build it up? After the Silver River Mine's next dividend is declared, we're going to be sitting on a pile of money. Then he grinned. I must be getting senile, but at least I'll be able to guarantee a job for my dropout journalist son. And the idea of Michael as editor of a large, influential newspaper had an increasing appeal, the longer he thought about it. Still, I wish the little blighter would get himself a decent education first, he grumbled. But he had almost forgiven him for his treachery by the time he parked the Jaguar in the parking area reserved for cabinet ministers. Of course I'll keep him on a decent allowance, he decided. That threat was just a little bluff. A sense of excited expectation gripped the house as Shaza went up the stairs to the front entrance. The lobby was crowded with senators and members of parliament. The knots of dark-suited men formed and dissolved and reformed in the intricate play of political cross-currents that fascinated Shaza. As an insider, he could read the significance of who was talking to whom and why. It took him almost 20 minutes to reach the foot of the staircase, for as one of the prime actors he was drawn inexorably into the subtle theatre of power and favour. At last he escaped, and with only minutes to spare, hurried up the stairs and down the passage to his suite. Tricia was hovering anxiously.
Mr. Courtney, everybody's looking for you. Lord Littleton telephoned, and the Prime Minister's secretary left a message.
She was reading from her pad as she followed him into the inner office. Try to get the PM's secretary first, then Lord Littleton. Shaza sat at his desk and frowned as he noticed some chalky white specks on his blotter. He brushed them away irritably and would have given Tricia an order to speak to the cleaners, but she was still reading from her pad, and he had less than an hour to tackle the main items on her list before the joint sitting began. He dealt with the queries that Favut's secretary had for him. The answers were in his head, and he did not have to refer to anybody in his department. And then Littleton was on the line. He wanted to discuss an addition to the agenda for their meeting that afternoon. And once they had agreed that, Shaza asked tactfully, "Have you found out anything about the speeches this morning?"
"Afraid not, old man. I'm as much in the dark as you are."
As Shaza reached across the desk to replace the receiver, he noticed another white speck of chalk on his blotter that had not been there a minute before. He was about to brush that away also when he paused and looked up to see where it had come from. This time he scowled as he saw the small hole in his ceiling and the hairline cracks around it. He pressed the switch on his intercom.
Tricia, please come in here a moment.
When she stood in the doorway, he pointed at the ceiling.
"What do you make of that?"
Tricia looked mystified and came to stand beside his chair. They both peered at the damage.
"Oh, I don't know," Tricia looked relieved. "But I'm not supposed to tell you."
"Spit it out, woman," Shaza ordered.
"Your wife, Mrs. Courtney, said she was planning some renovations to your office as a surprise. I suppose she's asked maintenance to do the work for her."
"Damn!" Shaza didn't like surprises which interfered with the comfortable tenor of his existence. He liked his office the way it was, and he didn't want anybody, particularly anybody of Tara's avant-garde taste, interfering with something that worked extremely well as it was.
"I think she's planning to change the curtains also," Tricia added innocently.
She didn't like Tara Courtney. She considered her shallow, insincere, and scheming. She didn't approve of her disrespectful attitude to Shaza, and she wasn't above sowing a few seeds of dissension. If Shaza were free, there was just a chance, a very small and remote chance, that he might see her clearly and realise just how much she, Tricia, felt for him.
"And she was talking about altering the light fittings," she added.
Shaza jumped up from his desk and went to touch his curtains. He and Santon had studied at least 100 samples of fabric before choosing this one. Protectively, he rearranged the drapes, and then he noticed the second hole in the ceiling and the thin insulated wire that protruded from it. He had difficulty controlling his fury in front of his secretary.
"You get on to maintenance," he instructed. "Talk to Odendahl himself, not one of his workmen, and you tell him I want to know exactly what is going on. Tell him whatever it is, it's damned shoddy workmanship, and that there's plaster all over my desk." I'll do that this morning, Tricia promised. And then placatingly, It's 10 minutes to, Mr. Courtney. You don't want to be late.
Manfred de la Rey was just leaving his own office as Sharza came down the passage, and they fell in side by side.
Have you found out anything?
No. Have you?
Manfred shook his head.
It's too late anyway. Nothing we can do now.
Sharza saw Blaine Malcolm-S at the door of the dining room and went to meet him. They filed into the panelled dining room together.
How's Mater?
Oh, Santon's fine. Looking forward to seeing you for dinner tomorrow evening.
Santon was holding a dinner party in Littleton's honour, out at Rhodes Hill.
I left her giving the chef a nervous breakdown.
They laughed together, and then found their seats in the front row of chairs.
As minister and deputy leader of the opposition, they both warranted reserved seats.
Sharza swiveled in his seat and looked to the back of the large hall where the press cameras had been set up. He picked out Kitty Godolphin, looking tiny and girlish, beside her camera crew, and she winked at him mischievously. Then the two prime ministers were taking their places at the top table, and Sharza leaned across to Manfred de la Rey and murmured,
I hope this isn't all a hoo-ha over nothing,
and that Supermac has really got something of interest to tell us.
Manfred shrugged. Let's hope it isn't too exciting either, he said. Sometimes it's safer to be bored.
But he broke off as the Speaker of the House called for silence and rose to introduce the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and the packed room, filled with the most powerful men in the land, settled into attentive and expectant silence. Even when Macmillan, tall and urbane, and strangely benign in expression, rose to his feet, Sharza had no sense of being at the anvil while history was being forged, and he crossed his arms over his chest and lowered his chin in the attitude of listening and concentration in which he followed all debate and argument. Macmillan spoke in an unemotional voice, but with weight and lucidity, and his text had all the indications of having been carefully prepared, meticulously polished and rehearsed.
The most striking of all the impressions I have formed since I left London a month ago, he said, is the strength of this African national consciousness. In different places, it may take different forms, but it is happening everywhere. The wind of change is blowing through the continent. Whether we like it or not, this growth of national consciousness is a political fact. We must all accept it as a fact. Our national policies must take account of it.
Sharza sat up straight and unfolded his arms, and around him there was a similar stirring of incredulity. It was only then that Sharza realized with a clairvoyant flash that the world he knew had altered its shape, that in the fabric of life that had held together their diverse nation for almost 300 years, the first rent had been torn by a few simple words, a rent that could never be repaired. While he attempted to grasp the full extent of the damage, Macmillan was going on in those plummy, measured tones.
Of course you understand this as well as anyone. You are sprung from Europe, the home of nationalism.
Cunningly, Macmillan was including them in his new sweeping view of Africa.
Indeed, in the history of our times, yours will be recorded as the first of the African nationalisms.
Sharza glanced at Favut beside the British Prime Minister, and he could see that he was agitated and alarmed. He had been caught unawares by Macmillan's stratagem of withholding his text from him.
As a fellow member of the Commonwealth, it is our earnest desire to give South Africa our support and encouragement. But I hope you won't mind me saying frankly that there are some aspects of your policies which make it impossible for us to do this without being false to our own deep convictions about the political destinies of free men.
Macmillan was announcing nothing less than a parting of ways, and Sharza was devastated by the idea. He wanted to leap to his feet and shout, But I am British also. You cannot do this to us. He looked around him almost pleadingly, and saw his own deep distress echoed on the faces of Blaine and most of the other English members of the House. Macmillan's words had devastated them. Sharza's mood persisted over the remainder of that day and the next. The atmosphere at the meetings with Littleton and his advisers
was one of mourning, and though Littleton himself was apologetic and conciliatory, they all knew that the damage was real and irreparable. The fact was undeniable. Britain was dropping them. She might go on trading with them, but at arm's length. Britain had chosen sides. Late on the Friday, a special session of the House was announced for the following Monday, when Verwoerd would make his accounting to his Parliament and his people. They had the weekend to brood over their fate. Macmillan's speech even cast a shadow over Santon's dinner party on the Friday evening, and Santon took it as a personal insult.
"The man's timing is atrocious," she confided to Shaza. "The day before my party, perfidious Albion."
"You French have never trusted the British," Shaza teased her, his first attempt at humour in 48 hours.
"Now I know why," Santon reported. "Look at the man. Typically English. He hides expediency in a cloak of high moral indignation. He does what is best for England and makes himself a saint while he does it."
It was left for Blaine Malcolm-Est to sum up after the women had left the men to their port and cigars in Rhodes Hill's magnificent dining room.
"Why are we so incredulous?" he asked. "Why do we feel it so impossible that Britain would reject us, simply because we fought 2 wars for her?"
He shook his head.
"No. The caravan moves on, and so must we. We must ignore the gloating of the London press. We must ignore their delight in this unprecedented rebuke and repudiation of all of us, the nationalists and those that strenuously oppose them. From now on, we will be increasingly alone, and we must learn to stand on our own feet."
Shaza nodded. Macmillan's speech was a huge political gain for Verwoerd. "There is only one way for us to go now. The bridge has been chopped down behind us. No retreat is possible. We have to go along with Verwoerd. South Africa will be a republic before the year is out. Mark my words." "And after that," Shaza drew on his cigar while he considered, "and after that, only God and the devil know for certain."